Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 91-year-old Cecil Blackford of Tehachapi, California, originally from Mobile, Iowa. He served as a Navy corpsman during World War II and the Korean War. When we left off, he was discussing his World War II duty aboard the hospital ship USS Solis, which evacuated thousands of wounded soldiers and Marines from the bloodiest battles in the Pacific. And I do want to warn you that we may get into some discussion about the scope and nature of the injuries that Cecil saw up close and personal. If you're squeamish, there may be a moment or two that might not be your cup of tea. Just a heads up. And Mr. Blackford, you told us how exhausting this could be, stretches of more than 30 hours without a break. But can you give us a taste of what your duties were as an operating room technician?
When we got our table, we had to help strip them and set them up and whatever that stuff was, get that all stripped up. We had to set up our instruments table, and that's when we had our mask and everything else on. Mm-hmm. And then we had to pass the instruments to the doctor as they needed them. Because some of our cases, they had cut from top by their chest all the way down to the top part of the leg. We've had them so bad that they had to be treated, everything washed out with saline and everything else, and bandaged up, everything else. And so it was up to us to be able to pass the instruments to the doctor as they called for them. Mm-hmm. Then afterwards, naturally, clean them all up, sterilize them, get them ready for the other, but we always had extra packs all sterilized, ready to go in action immediately anyway. But it was very good. They called Wes and I the torture department. When we come through, we were to torture, because when you put those guys in straps and stretch them and bones and all that, why, you didn't pay attention. If they hollered or said anything, that's tough. Because like the doctor said, hurry up, the quicker you get this here done, the better off.
So part of your job, you get a stretcher or a gurney that's got a wounded Marine on it, and you've got to tie him down so he can go through the operation without compromising it.
Well, someone along the line has taken him and put him in.
Yeah.
And he might be on a stretcher in, you know, waiting to go next on. If you had a case on it, you had to finish that their part. Mm-hmm. But the orthosurgical part, they would naturally have to go to maybe something more serious to want to get. You had three tables, 1, 2, and 1, 3. You had three different operating tables with the lights and everything above.
Right.
Everything.
But part of your job was tying these guys down.
Oh, yeah.
And not caring if they scream in pain or tell you to stop.
More or less.
That's just what you had to do.
After they get a shot, spinal injection, or else they had an anesthetist. She was a woman nurse. It was up to her to handle the putting them to sleep or whatever, and the doctor to take over, and you just be scrubbed up, and you would just assist them. Everything else, you just did accordingly. Sometimes then you had to put the plaster all the way around, you know, body cast, which would be way down below their knee on one, and the other one up above by their hip. That was it, because they would only be aboard our ship 7 or 8 days. By that time, we'd be pulled into someplace where they would be taken off and used for further there, or maybe a lot of them then would be transferred. Maybe they flew them, certain cases, back to states or wherever.
So I think people are getting the picture that the purpose of this ship is not to be a long-term care facility. It is, in the short term, you're saving some lives and you're passing them off to a hospital where they can recover. So you got a lot of guys coming in and out, and then you guys are always moving to go pick up new crews.
Right.
You probably couldn't even imagine how many people total you guys treated on that ship because of how fast they were coming in and out.
They were coming out pretty fast. We had a trip, and last, like I said, it was not a hospital. Ships are much larger in how many get on them.
And you said that eventually the patients you're working with were just another guy, another number. But was it always like that at the beginning? Did you feel some of that pain and agony as you watched them going through what they were going through?
Oh, some of them, yes. Some of them you can't help but feel. We had one guy so stripped down and everything else, and about 10, 11 days, he was aboard our ship. He was on his own. And we'd ask, and finally one day, all of one sudden, we think he's really going to pull through. And all of once, they said, well, so-and-so, surgical one, passed away last night or something like that. You know?
Yeah.
And so sometimes they'd be so stripped and so ripped apart. Like I got pictures of showing the wounds that we worked on that table, showing where they was ripped apart in different places and everything else.
There is an emotional toll of that job weighs on you.
Oh, yeah. I don't forget. A lot of those, I see them. But we worked together as a team. Mm-hmm. Our ship crew, we just got along great. And our ship had been bombed one night. They missed the bomb come off our fantail. Luckily, some kamikaze, when they said set condition one, all hands. At that time, the bomb, you feel the ship was rattling all over the place. You knew it and couldn't believe it, because hospital ships supposedly went out and lit up like a hospital, like a big city.
Yeah.
Because Japs and Germans were supposed to observe them, same as we were supposed to observe their hospital ships.
So you're working and you feel the impact?
Well, at the time when it happened, we were sitting in the WENT, i.e. nose and throat, ward. We were sitting in that operating room. We were talking, writing a letter, just talking, you know, it's all. And when it hit, when that bomb struck and hit, we were just shaking all over the place. And then we had put up iron braces on the windows and everything. The lights went out. I guess then they changed their course.
So it didn't hit you. It hit near you, but you guys
right
could feel
the fantail. Right, yeah. The fantail is just, if there had been a little bit more, we would. We had patience aboard. You can imagine if that would have struck that ship, it would have been a really catastrophe.
Yeah, it would have been a great tragedy, and it was probably something you hadn't really thought about before?
No, we just took for granted. We took for granted we had a safe, you know, whatever.
You thought your markings and the fact that it was clearly a hospital ship would protect you, and now all of a sudden that's not true anymore.
We found out because at the same time, the Comfort got hit too, right around about that time. So I guess they decided that time, forget it. I don't know. They just give up because they more or less started against your safety. So we had to end up with the destroyer escort, two of them, following way behind us.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, if those that weren't on duty had to go down and stand watch if they had time to walk to look out for any submarines or anything, you know, anything.
You mentioned photos of some of the wounds and injuries that you guys dealt with. Can you paint a picture for us? Some of the kinds of injuries that you guys saw, that you guys tried to help with in this operating room?
Missing legs.
Yeah.
Different shoulders and different places where they are wounded. It's up to us then to dress them and everything else.
You've been on an honor flight, right?
Oh, yes.
You've been to the National World, and I'll ask you about that in a bit, but, you know, there at the Wall of Gold Stars, representing 406,000 Americans who died in World War II, it says, here we mark the price of freedom. A lot of VA hospitals, if you go to it, there's a sign above the door, it says, the price of freedom is visible here. And I'm just thinking about you in those situations. I mean, if you want to talk about the price of freedom, and the guys that are paying something for it, you're looking at them on a daily basis, guys that whose lives are going to be forever changed because of these injuries. Are there maybe an example or two that pop into your mind of injuries that you saw that you thought, boy, that's really bad?
Yeah, a lot of injuries you can see that word. They were very bad, a lot of them.
What were some of the worst ones that you remember?
The worst one I can remember is one where he's ripped open from here down into the lower part of the leg.
From his chest down to his knee, basically?
I see chest down to the base. He was opened up and his flesh, his stomach was opened up. Where actually when we changed those air dressings and everything, we had to throw a lot of saline to wash the magnets out and treat it. I watched that and that I think of quite often.
Did you ever look at one of these guys and say, how is this guy alive?
I'd say, yeah, this guy there, I think he was one after so long a time. He did die. He was cut. So we thought he was going to pull through. He did not pull through. One of the other things that bothers that happened, Captain Peterson, the nurse, and myself, we were talking in ENT ward. And all of a sudden, the ship just listed way over. And boy, we ran out. We looked over the railing at Dick, and there was a great big mine, all those things sticking out. And happened to be Bob Robidoux. I owe my life to him. He's the one that spotted that mine, and I forget what the guy's name that managed to do something through the ship or do something. It managed it to go around that mine, and we would look out and see this. Boy, if he hadn't seen that, we would have hit that mine with all it loaded down with patients. You can imagine what would happen. So now I'm hoping we have a reunion coming up, and I'm hoping able to make it. And I hope he is still living. I figure when I see him, I owe my life to that guy.
Have you had the chance to thank him before?
Oh, yeah. I had a reunion down at San Diego. I was host of the reunion. I got up and started talking, and I brought it before all of them that this man, that he was the one that noticed that mine and saved us. Mm-hmm. And you know, he told me, he said later on, you know, I never said much to anybody on that. But he says that was the first time I had recognized it and brought it out and tried giving him credit for what that was. But that was the two things I remembered, with Common Cause, bombing, missing, and this mine. Those two of all the time, years, that was the main thing.
Those were the close calls for you.
Right.
But your daily job, your everyday existence, was dealing with guys who had really close calls that would have killed them if you guys weren't there to help save them. So I'm just thinking about you saying, this guy saved your life. There's a lot of guys out there that came home from the war saying, you and those doctors and the people on the Solis helped save their lives.
I had one occasion. I was going down the street in San Francisco on one of my liberties, and I looked down, and this guy hollered, "Hey, Blackie. And, you know, I went over him, and he remembered. He says, "You saved my life. You've donated blood." Because they were asking for anybody that able to, they would give us a choice, a shot of whiskey or $25 for that blood.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that was it, that he remembered me in San Francisco, in one of the streets on Liberty.
Wow.
I never did forget that.
I can tell, so, just looking in your eyes right now, that's still a pretty powerful emotional memory for you.
Oh, yeah. See, I wasn't. Which bothers me very much. The fact is, I wasn't 21 yet, and bars were not. I might be in uniform. We'd go out and fight, but we couldn't possibly be in a bar legally. And so what he did, he said, "Come with me. We're going to go in and have a few shots," or what. And we went into a bar, and he told the gal there, he says, "This is a friend of mine. He's my buddy. He saved my life. He knows that he's not of age, but she's okay. Don't worry, I'll take care of it." And so I was able to stay there until whatever time.
Well, and you bring that up, and that brings a lot of other questions to mind. So here you are. You talked about how exhausting this work can do. I mean, at one point, you're there for more than 30 hours straight working on guys in this room. But they're asking the crew of this ship, the people that serve on it, to donate blood to help save lives. How often did that actually happen? How often did you give blood?
I just did it one time. I mean, yeah. It didn't seem to happen. We had like a blood plasma that we gave in place of blood.
Right.
And we had so much of that. And why they was calling for blood, straight blood, I don't know. But at that time, I donated some blood.
So it was more of a on-the-spot thing. It was an emergency situation. They needed someone to give the blood.
Yeah, I guess so. They had it handy. Had to have it handy for some cases.
Mm-hmm.
And have to be that was it, and he noticed it. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I'll never forget that one.
And what are the odds of running into him on the streets of San Francisco?
So different. The odds are astronomical. That's be about it. It was just, I couldn't believe it.
And you mentioned the two doctors that you worked primarily with.
Dr. Cole and Dr. Neal, both of them worked in the, mainly on the bones and on that orthopedic table.
Well, I bring that back up because I'm just thinking about what you shared about yourself, about, you know, how tiring this could be and how you guys just had to keep going and going. And then I'm thinking about a surgeon going for that long straight. And it's not like there's a bunch of other guys waiting to take over for them. I mean, if there are patients that need it, they have to keep going. What did you appreciate the most about those doctors and what you saw them do?
Well, I saw them do the things they did and work in that way and everything. They were great. As far as I'm concerned, I had a lot of respect for Dr. Neal and Dr. Cole. And the same as one of the psychiatrists that worked on shock on some people like this. One patient, his eyes, he couldn't see. He'd been shot. His eyes. And this guy, doctor, put him in this as in ENT ward. He told him, now, because he knew he should be okay. And he told him, now, I know you can't see now, but I know you'll be able to see, just relax and everything. And they was giving him sodium pentothal, just a shot, not too much. They didn't want him to go to sleep. He said, now, this is it. He talked, he changed his brain, his mind. And first thing you know, before he got through, he was able to recognize different things in that operating room. Mm. And he said, what's that man wearing, or this and that, and questions. And we were standing watching this doctor, and they all thought he was a quack. And he said, well, no, he said, you're going to go to sleep. But when you wake up, you're going to be able to see everything. And, you know, when he woke up, he could see. His eyesight came back. And I thought, boy, no one can call him a quack. As far as I was concerned.
Results speak for themselves,
Results. I'll never forget that one, that's for sure.
I think we can all see why you wouldn't. It's break time again, but we're not done with Cecil's story. We'll catch the rest of his World War II experiences, plus what he did during the Korean War, and a more recent mission with Honor Flight Kern County. Check out the photos and video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.